by Jeffrey.
Who's that?
I don't know. Are you ready to start this thing? Yep.
Yeah, I'm ready to go. This is Jeff Lindahl and my sidekick, Jeannie Olowski. This is on the Mastery Let's Grill Jeannie call. And one of the things you want to be doing, besides looking for deals, making real estate brokers relationship, is to make 2 private money contacts every week. And that's what David said. You have to be out there networking for private money, looking for deals, and market knowledge. So the Let's Grill Jeannie's is the person, is the go-to person when a deal comes through. To Dave, she goes, Jeannie, who do we have in that market that wants to invest in that market? And Jeannie just does her thing. And she knows how to talk to investors, how to track them. She knows everything about the private money side of the business. That's why we have her on the call today. So if you have any questions at all, plus she's an expert on deal analysis, anything that you learned at the Multifamily Millions Boot Camp that you have questions on, or if you're stuck with something in your process right now, just ask her, right? So what you want to do is press *0, and you'll get right into the queue. So, Jeannie, how you doing today?
I'm doing excellent. That was quite the introduction. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I would like to welcome all the new Mastery students from San Francisco, California last weekend. And just a short reminder that we need your student data form for Diamond, Gold, and Silver Mastery students. Today's high five goes to Vic, Raya, and Ravi Gupta. Just closed on 118 units in Atlanta and have submitted an LOI for the property next door for 72 units, and they're going to combine the 2 properties into one larger one. There's some static on the line. I'm not sure where it's coming from, but I'm on a landline.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't know what that is, Jeff.
All right, I'll queue in there to find out. But you can keep going.
Okay. So anyways, they're excited with the training, and their investors are looking for more deals to get into. Their next closing, they hope to have 200 units or so in the southeast of the United States. So if anybody's got a deal and they're looking for people, you can reach out to them. Just give me a call, and I'll hook you up with them. So does anybody have any questions pressing right now, operator? She may be getting the static off the line, so I'll just keep going. Andy Showers writes in, I recall from immersion training and multifamily boot camp.
Okay, so what she's doing right now, she's muting Jeannie out to see if it's her line. And she, she'll be doing mine. So remember, press *0 to get in to ask. This is a Q&A for the next hour. So if you have any questions at all, if you want to introduce yourself, you can do that.
All right, so I'm going to ask Andy Schauer's question over again. I recall from immersion training and multifamily boot camp that flat roofs are not good. We are currently working on a deal on a 100-unit property in Texas that has a flat roof and want to know the downside risks associated with it in the future. Well, the problem with flat roofs is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have a tendency to not lend on flat roofs. There's ways of getting around it by putting these cone-shaped devices on top of the roofs, but we usually recommend to stay clear of it. I would check with your current lender and find out if there's a problem getting financing for the flat roof. And then you have to really consider when you go to sell, will they be able to get funding for it? That's the real risk that we see. Any questions, operator?
Yes, we do. We actually have one. The first question comes from Mark. Mark, please go ahead.
Hi, Jeannie. It's Mark Dupuis from Ottawa, Ontario.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Excellent. I got a question regarding, we've got a LOI on 166 units in Lexington, Kentucky. And we're trying to get, the seller apparently has two or three other LOIs, and he's kind of dancing around, and he's not sure which one to take. And apparently one of the other offers is higher than ours. I'm not sure how much, but the broker on one of the on the seller's side kind of alluded to my broker that, you know, we might be $500,000 apart. And for me, it's all about the numbers, right? The numbers don't support the number,
right,
you know, going up another $500,000. So I told him, I said, listen, what if I was to show you that, because I just seem to think that since he's not flat out just accepting the other offer, he's obviously got some concerns, or maybe it's not really true that he were $500,000 apart. So I thought if we showed him that we've got some strength financially to be able to close this, that gives him that kind of a peace of mind that we can close, that we could, you know, might, that might sway him one way or another. So,
well,
I'm kind
I think
of hoping
that's absolutely a good point. However, those backup offers that you're talking about, they may have contingencies that the owner is not willing to accept. It might be contingent on the sale of another property or contingent on the timing of a 1031 exchange. I mean, you don't know. If they're $500,000 off, I have a tendency to think it's a 1031 exchange and they want to use the whole thing and then maybe cash out some of the money later on. That's just what I'm thinking. So it could be contingencies that they're not willing to accept.
Okay. So you think it's not worth us trying to get some kind of proof of funds together to
No,
kind of
I think it
to...
is. I think it's a good
okay.
idea to get leveraged that way. But if they're not willing to tell you why they haven't accepted a backup offer, I'm just throwing my theory out there. And it's, I
okay.
mean, there's nothing grounded on it. It just makes sense to me that there's some contingencies in play that they're not willing to overcome.
Okay. So my second question then is, I'm not sure exactly who's going to fund this deal. I've got a couple of people that I've been talking to, but I mean, without having an LOI, having a contract actually in place, I can't really approach anybody and say, hey, we've got this thing under contract. Are you willing to put up proof of funds? How do I go about getting proof of funds prior to having it under contract and prior to having that LOI accepted?
Well, normally we send people to besttransactionfunding.com for a proof of funds letter. However, the brokers are getting a little bit sharper in accepting those, and he may squawk a little bit, but you can try it, get a proof of funds letter for the entire amount and see if that passes. The other thing is, if you're going to need a sponsor on the deal, I would
yep.
get some kind of a little credibility kit from your sponsor. And you yourself, you and Amanda, aren't you both doing single families? So that's some credibility that you can close deals. And you're just jumping
yeah.
up into a new market. So they're just wanting to see who you are and how long you can stay at the party here.
Right. So what was that website again? Besttransactionfunding.com. Funding.com. Okay. I will try that. Perfect.
Okay.
Thank you.
And didn't you go to the Wilson conference?
No, I didn't.
You didn't. Well, that would have been a smart idea because then you could have used the credibility of one of those people that you met there to have hundreds of millions of dollars.
I didn't know about it until I was in Boston when I found out about it, and it was that
yeah.
the following Monday.
It was just too soon,
Let me ask you a question, Mark. If you get this deal accepted at the price that you're looking at, how quick do you think you'll be able to fund that when you get it on a contract? Do you have like investors that are lined up that you think will you can put into the deal?
I don't have anything concrete lined up, no.
All right.
I've spoken to a few people that have said that if I bought them a good deal, they'd fund it, but I don't have anything concrete yet.
And where is the property located?
It's in Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh, yeah, Lexington, Kentucky.
Yep.
So I was thinking
that's a good upside.
If you had people on your investor list that were looking in that market, I would try the walk-away strategy for negotiations and give them until Thursday to make a decision on it and tell your broker, basically, like, hey, we have two or three other properties in this market that we're getting ready to take down, so I don't want to spend too much more time on this. So this is it. You know, he needs to give me a decision on Thursday by 5, and then you either get it or not. Otherwise, you could be doing a dance with this on a seller for a little while.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, too. I mean, he probably doesn't have any other offers, and he's just dancing around hoping you'll come up with your offer. So he's leaving it open-ended, and you could be sitting on this for a couple of weeks and not know if you've got this ready to rock and roll or not. So everything's like at a standstill. You have to have a closure date. And then make up your mind, if we're not in the limelight, keep us in as a backup offer, and if we have availability, we'll come back and revisit. You take the ball and you run with it.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I'll do. Okay. That's a good point. Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Okay. Up next, we have Ron. Ron, please go ahead.
Hi, Jeannie. This is Ron Howard of RJH Capital. How are you doing today?
How are you? I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Good. It's been a while since we spoke. But, Jeannie, I am looking at a deal here in Texas, and it's 120 units and built in two phases, one in 64. The majority of it was built in 64, and the others in the late 70s, I think 78. Well, when calling around to verify commercial insurance, you know, I've called two companies already, and after their review, they're saying that the property is too old and it's something that they would not underwrite when it comes to insurance. Can you give me some insight as to how to overcome this? I'm certainly, you know, there's a lot of old deals out there people insure.
I think it's more of when it's last updated. I mean, it could have a brand new roof. It could have a new siding or brick or something on it, and it could be completely updated and remodeled. I mean, they're generalizing the year. I mean, in Texas, things last forever. Did you try
right.
Michael Shadid?
I did email Michael, and I've not got a response, but I emailed him on Friday, so, you know, I'll follow up again today.
Well, I'll give you his cell phone number, and you can reach out to him and just ask
okay,
him.
That'd be great. Sure.
678.
Wait a minute. You shouldn't get that on the line. Like, if people
he told
want
me
to
it was
on,
okay.
So. Oh, he did.
He told me, yeah, he said anytime I want to give it out, give it out.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's 678-428-7953.
Do you have Derek Giles' contact information too, Jeannie?
Do I have what?
Derek Giles, the other insurance broker.
No, I don't. I don't have him. Do you have him?
I do. I know I have him in my Rolodex. So, Ryan, I'll send that out to you. Yeah.
Thank you, Jermaine. I appreciate it.
That's Jeff, not
okay.
Jermaine.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff.
Right church, wrong pew.
I don't.
Jermaine will send it to you, though. He just volunteered.
Sounds good. I don't know you guys yet by the names, the voices.
What do you mean,
voices.
Ryan? I met you at the immersion training.
No, absolutely. It's just been a while since I've talked to you guys.
You don't know the Boston accent? Come on. Remember Bok Bok Chada?
Bok. Yeah, the Chada. Got it. I use that one all the time myself now. Well, thanks a bunch, everyone.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Okay, we have no further questions at the moment.
Okay, a couple questions came in the door. So, the first one is from Mark White. What is a better investment for an investor? I have a deal that is $6 million, but 20 units in New York. When I do the numbers, the deal doesn't meet the Holy Trinity. My question is, am I wasting my time with properties in New York? And if so, what price range are investors looking for and how many units? Well, A, the investors are not looking for how many units. They're looking for their cash-on-cash return. And if you can't get them an 8% preferred rate of return, doesn't matter how many units it is, as long as the cash-on-cash gets them what they need. I mean, 20 units in New York, I know the rents are really high there, but I think for $6 million, you can get a 200-unit property in Texas versus a 20-unit property in New York. And Texas is landlord-friendly, and you can pretty much guarantee that your investor's going to get a better than 8% return on their investment. Anything to add, Jeffrey?
No, I agree totally with what you just said.
Okay, he wasn't listening. He was probably doing homework. The next question we had came from Randy Buffy. I have a couple of clarifications. Do I understand correctly that the loss or gain to lease is for unpaid rent and related expenses to unpaid rent, and the physical vacancy is their actual vacancy cost for unoccupied units? So the vacancy physical is for unoccupied units. The loss to lease or gain to lease could be where they are in the marketplace. If properties all around them are $100 a door higher than they are and they meet the same criteria and they have the same amenities, you're losing money by not raising rents. So that's what the loss to lease is. It's not for unpaid rent. Concessions could be for your credit loss or unpaid rents, et cetera, but not your loss to lease. Any questions, operator? I guess not. Or maybe there are.
Yeah, there are, because she's like, she's probably gathering the people right now.
Okay.
Are you doing any races right now, Jeannie?
No, although something might be coming down the pike soon.
Nice.
But nope, I don't have any races, and I have people raising their hand. They want to give me money. But I don't have any raises. I'm all done with everything.
You're so efficient.
Which is good. It's good for Dave. It's not good to keep yourself in front of people when you haven't got any properties to raise money for, though. Because when you're in their face, they pay attention.
So why don't you go over Dave's criteria for a deal? What's Dave looking for in case anyone has a deal out there?
Well, typically we like 150 units and above. We like it to be in an emerging market. Dave specifically likes the Southeast because he wants to be able to leave his house and get there and get home in the same day. So anything from Boston all the way up to, you know, the end of Florida, in some parts of Texas, he can get there and get home the same day. Anything on the West Coast, he cannot do that. And he doesn't like to stay overnight. because he's got those two little cherubs he's taking care of now. And his criteria is it's got to meet the Holy Trinity. And the unit mix has to be right as well. So for every one bedroom, you want two bedrooms. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of properties with single units, and that they're the majority, and that is just not the model that we teach you. We want to, resident retention is key. So if they get married and they're going to have a kid, they have to go and leave your premises to get an apartment that has a second bedroom. But if you have the right unit mix, you can step them into a two-bedroom and not lose them as tenants. And that's really key. Any questions, operator? Okay, I got a bunch of questions emailed. So I have an A-type property where the cap rate is less than 4%. I spoke to some people who told me that I shouldn't be going after A's. I should be in the B and C range. I was wondering if you can explain to me why A's are not preferred and why investors like B's and C's. Well, mainly A's, I mean, a 4% cap rate is not going to give you the Holy Trinity. You need to be up around the 8% cap rate. But the reason why we don't go after A's is because of the cash-on-cash return to the investors. Because you're committing to your investors that you'll give them an 8% preferred rate of return. So on an A-class property, they've already reached the top of the market, and they don't have any place left to go. So you really are not getting that influx in rents because they're already reached it. There's some A's that you can go after with a good value play, but you really, they're very few and far between. We've only bought one A-class property in all the years we've been buying properties. And the way we got around it was we reduced the length of time we held it. So instead of being a five-year hold, we reduced it to 3 years so that we could get the annualized rate of return up over 20, which is the goal. And how you figure the annualized rate of return for those that are new is you take the interest that they're making on the property yearly plus their equity position, and you add them together and divide it by the number of the years. So if they're getting an 8 or 9% return for the next 3 years, that's a 24 to 27% return. And say they're getting a 50% return on the back end, so you take the 50, add it to the 24, and divide that by 3. And that's how you get your annualized rate of return. So we like to be in the 20 to 23% market. Anything more than that is like gravy for the investors. But if somebody's getting a 23% annualized rate of return, they're in, and they're looking to plunk their money in because they know it's a sound investment, and they're not going to get that anywhere else. So I'll go back to this question by Joe Bell. I was wondering if you can explain to me why A's are not preferred and why investors like B's and C's. B's and C's, you can always strive to make them a better class property, which is going to produce better rents. But if you're sitting with an A and you're at the top of the range, you have no place to go. And C's, you can make more like a B, and it will command a higher rent. And that's really the reason for buying these types of B and C properties is the value play. Anything you want to add there, Jeff?
Well, I think the competition that you have, too, if you're looking at A's, you have all the REITs and everything. There are A properties like that are in C areas. So it's like then you have to look at your tenant profile, too. So I would like B's are good. C's, you get more cash flow. There's more risk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the property intensive. But C's and B's, that's where you want to be.
Yeah. So the next question comes from Brene Robinson. As a beginner, do you recommend an ideal number of units to look for on a deal so that the sponsors are more enticed to do business with you? Or do you just recommend getting a great deal under your belt, even if it's a smaller deal? I say go where you're comfortable, Brene. You don't want to be going after a 100-unit property when 20 is your market. So I say go wherever you are comfortable and wherever you can command investors and audience to participate in the deal with you. And I don't really think it matters to the sponsor as long as the deal makes sense. Some, of course, like bigger deals, but there's a lot of sponsors that like the little ones because they're easier to manage. They can control them better. And you can do a lot of great things with smaller properties. So if 20 units is your ideal number, that's what you want to go to. Anything you want to add, Jeff?
Nope, you got to start where you're comfortable. Plus, you have to look in your local market because there's like different. There's always properties. We're still buying three families in our local area. So it's like cash flow is cash flow. It doesn't matter where you start.
Operator, any questions?
We have no questions at the moment.
Okay. I don't feel popular today, guys. All right, another one got sent in. I just did a rehab on half of my apartments in my apartment complex. My management company wants to give concessions to get people to move into the new units, but I don't think it's a good idea because that cuts into my margins. My question, should you give concessions to get tenants to move in if your apartment is under 70% occupancy? I want to get your expertise. Well, Jose, it really depends. I mean, you just bought this property. You just rehabbed those units. Have you even marketed to the masses to see if you could sell them out without concessions? And it also depends on what is near you. Are they giving move-in specials? And you got to be careful with them because they could be giving a move-in special of $99 this month and then giving them a free month later on during the year, which you don't want to do because then you're completely exposed. So it really depends on your area, where you bought it, and what's going on with your neighboring properties. I mean, I don't like giving concessions. If you don't need it, don't give it. But if you think you need it because you're not getting any foot traffic, or maybe the management company is just looking for an easy way to fill it up. But I don't really like concessions, unless you have to. If you have a ton of competition and they're all giving move-in specials, then you may want to follow suit. But if you don't, I would just go, if you rent out two or three a week until the 15 that you have vacant are filled, I think you'll be fine.
I would say we're, what's his tenant profile? Is it Millennium? So who's he targeting for tenants?
He really doesn't say, and I'm not sure where he's tagging because he just finished rehabbing. He only bought this property less than 60 days ago. So he went down to 50% occupied, and now he's leasing up. And I think the management company is rushing him to get them leased up all at one time. But I say, you know, see how your marketing goes. See if you can get people in there without giving them a concession.
Yeah, I would like definitely like look to see how their marketing is working, how many like people are coming in, how many they're converting to. Maybe they're having a problem leasing up because they're not like marketing to the right people. If it's Millennium, see who the competition is and Google their the apartment name and see what pops up. See if they're like see if they're marketing through YouTube, showing what the apartment looks like to get the millennials in there, because we all know they're always on their iPhones, clicking away on different things. So that's the approach. That's what I was wondering, what the tenant profile is, and he can ask his property manager and like to see where it is. Where's the competition bringing in people from? Is it a business? Are they reaching out to the HR department, telling them that they have like clean, safe places for their new employees to live? So I would throw it back on the property management company and really like find out what leads are coming in through their marketing, and maybe they need to make an adjustment.
Good answer, Jeffrey. All right, so I have another question. I am working with an investor. I found a property, but it does not have a sales price on it. Is this something I should continue with? They want us to make an offer based on the cap. Is this usual, or are other students seeing this trend? Well, there's a couple of things going on here. Number one, the owner might be emotionally attached to the property and giving the broker a huge price tag, and the broker is putting out there to see the best offers that come in on the property based on the numbers. And then the other thing I would look at is, how long have they owned it? Are they just like other properties in the marketplace? And I kind of like it when they don't give a sales price, because you're working with your numbers and you're giving the price to your benefit. So I would do it as if you're getting the Holy Trinity numbers at 12% cash and cash return, a debt coverage ratio of 1.6, and a cap rate of 8 or higher. And do the numbers that way, and whatever the price comes up, that's your strike price. Drop down 10%, start your offer there. And they either accept or they don't accept. And when you hit the strike price, that's your final, best and final offer on the property. And they either take it or they don't. Anything from you, Jeff?
Yeah, I agree, right? Like, usually they're called TBDs, to be determined. So those are like the best like properties for myself to go after, because you're putting an offer based on your investors. If you have investors that are looking for the 8% cash on cash return right out of the gate, then that's how you have to determine what your strike price is. If it's a deal that has value plays and you have a partner that has experience in that market, raising rents or doing the rehabs to the units to capture what you want to capture in 2 years, 3 years, and then you underwrite for that. But the conversation, what you should review, and it's you should review Dave's he calls it the low ball offer, but it's like 2/3 of the way in your multifamily millions bootcamp manual. He has it scripted out well, where you put the offer in, and then it's basically, by the way, this is the way my investors, this is what I need for my investors. Do you have any off-market or deals? And that will get you some off-market deals that might make a little bit more sense. And a lot of times they're just like throwing out a property to see who bites on it and stuff. So just hit them with that. If you go up to module 9, there's a call up there with Dave's. It's just a short call called Finding Deals with RE Brokers. And during that call, Dave goes into that low ball offer too. So you can listen to that.
So in case you didn't know, you have to hit a *0 before you can get on the call. I understand some people are hitting 0, and it seems like I'm getting an unusual amount of emails with questions on it. So I'm thinking that people didn't put the star before the 0. So here's another question. This came from Frank Herman. He's a new master student from San Francisco. My name is Frank Herman, and I currently sell residential real estate in the Bay Area, and we are seeing a top in the market. My question is, how do I know that we are not at the top of the market in multifamily in certain areas? If the deal meets the Holy Trinity and we hold the deal for 3 to 5 years, will we be okay to not lose money on the deal when we sell? This is all new to me, so I want to be cautious for my investors when we sell the deal. Well, you always run that risk of, you know, the market squeezing out like it did in 2009-10, where we stopped buying to shore up all our properties because the rest of the country was in this meltdown with the banks and, you know, the government bailing out the auto industry and people moving home to their families because they couldn't afford the rents anymore. So you really have to watch the trends. But if you buy in a certain area, I mean, especially San Francisco, I mean, people move there all the time. I mean, the rents there for a studio is like $3,000 a month. I mean, if you buy in a place that there's a ton of job growth coming in and you can watch that market trend, then you'll be safe. And your whole thing is you want to protect your investors so that you don't lose them and that you give them the best communication possible. So, I mean, if you're buying in San Francisco right now, there's a ton of stuff going on there. And, you know, in 3 to 5 years, if you have to hold it longer, explain that to your investors as you're coming into a downward cycle that we may have to hold longer. It's all about communication. Jeff, you got anything to add?
Yeah, what you want to do, like 10-year balloons on your financing? You want to spread it out? Eric Stewart explained it very well on a recent call. Jermaine, do you know what call that is? Jermaine on the moderator line?
No, he's not.
All right. So there's a call where Eric Stewart said on the lending side of it what the strategy is, and we'll send that out to him. But basically, that's how you're going to protect yourself too.
So we're going to send that to you, Frank. But I want to add also, if you do have a 10-year balloon on your property, make sure that your property mortgage can be assumed and that there's enough years left on the mortgage that somebody else can have it assumed again. So if you got a 3 or 5 year hold, make sure that there's enough room left when you go to sell it so that you can cover your investors and not make them nervous at all.
Good point.
Okay, we have a live question. Are we ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, up next we have Lee. Lee, please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Jeannie, for just mentioning Star Zero. I'm having a problem getting through. I just want a question. It's really a clarification. There was a gentleman on earlier who had a property in Lexington, Kentucky, and you referred him to Best Transaction Funding or bestfundingtransaction.com to approve the fund. And you also mentioned that you asked him if he attended a particular conference where people had literally hundreds of millions of dollars collectively. I'm assuming, was that Ultimate Partnership, which is coming up in July?
No. No, it was not one of ours. It was called the Wilson Conference, and it is the family offices where a lot of these big, high net worth families who have hundreds of millions of dollars are looking to place their money into real estate. Dave happened to be speaking at one of them for 15 minutes and opened the doorway to some students to come along. He's done this 2 or 3 times where students go to the Wilson Conference as Dave's guest. They get a $100 discount off the tuition for coming with us, and they get to meet high net worth individuals. And the website we spoke about is besttransactionfunding.com.
Okay. And is and that, Wilson, that just happened? I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Wilson Conferences, if you go on their website and click down the drop-down menu for real estate, you'll see where their conferences are. I believe today they may be in Chicagoland. Wilson is one, and Opal Financial Group is another. They both do this culmination of real estate attendees that have their families have lots and lots of funds. I know Dave was able to pick up a $100 million investor, and Bob Bowman as well. So there, it's a place where if you can get there, you want to get there.
Okay, and Wilson Conference, I could Google it and I'll get the website?
Yep, wilson.com is the website.
And the second one was Opal, O-P-A-L, Financial Group?
Yep, Financial Group, yep.
Okay, and would you happen to know their website as well?
That's it, opalfinancialgroup.com.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, up next we have Joe. Joe, please go ahead.
Hello, guys. Joe from Cherry Hill. How are you?
Good, Joe. How are you?
I'm fine. A couple of questions. I hear fluctuations in the Trinity numbers, cash return.
It's got to be 12 or higher. There is no fluctuation.
Okay.
There's never a fluctuation. The numbers for the Trinity are 12% cash on cash return, a 1.6 debt coverage ratio, and an 8% or higher cap rate.
Correct. Okay, very good. My next question is, looking in the cap rates that are less than 8%, like 6.5 or 7.5, is it okay to present that kind of a cap rate if everything else falls in line?
It won't fall in line. If the cash on cash is 12, everything falls in line. It doesn't fall in line when the debt coverage ratio is there. I mean, it doesn't fall in line if you have a cap rate. It falls in line if you have the cash on cash right.
Okay. So if I'm looking, I'm analyzing a property at 7 cap rate, I just have to tweak the numbers until I get to at least 8, correct?
Lower the price. That's it.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Thank you much.
Okay. Sure thing.
Okay, we have no further questions at the moment. And just as a friendly reminder, if you have a question, please press *0 questions, please. Thank you.
Okay, the next question, there's several of them, comes from Lynn Beeman from Baltimore, Maryland. I plan to be on the call this afternoon, but I wanted to submit some questions in case I am not able to make it or if you find there is some dead space on the call. I am taking the home study private money course. Can you quickly explain the difference between debt partners and equity partners? How is equity divided between yourself and private money investors when the property is sold? So a debt partner gets a simple interest payment annually. So typically it's maybe 10 or 12%. They get absolutely no equity in the property at all. So once you pay back the debt and they get their interest, whether there's any money in the deal or not, they get that same interest payment, say it's 12%. So you're in that deal for 3 years. They get 12% the first year, 12% the second year, 12% the third year, and then you pay them back the money that you took from them. That's a debt partner. Very difficult to get debt partners. Equity partners, they take a place in the deal. So typically, if it's a 50-50 split, you and your partner or sponsor will take 50% and give 50% to the equity partners. The equity partners get an interest rate, which is a return of principal, by the way. People call it an interest rate, but it is their return of principal. And then they get that either quarterly, in some cases we pay monthly, but quarterly interest payments. And then from what you buy it for to what you sell it for, minus out anything they have left in the deal, you're giving back to them, along with the repayment of the debt on the property. Then you've got this pie left over, and that's a 50-50 split between you and them. So you take whatever you paid them for interest throughout the life of the loan, and then you take 50% and you add those two figures together and divide it by the amount of years, and that's where you get your annualized rate of return. So that is generally the way you do it. I mean, if you can get debt partners, that's great, but most of the time it's very difficult to get. The second question from Lynn comes, do debt partners typically fund entire deals, or is it typical 80% loan to value when using borrowed funds? In my history, it's always been they put up the down payment, not the mortgage amount. So the 80% loan to value, you'd be paying a bank or a credit union or whatever you're using, and the down payment as well as any other out-of-pocket costs will be covered by the debt partner. Thirdly, I'm finding that most of my offers that meet the Trinity usually using historical financials, T12s, are about 65% of the winning offer. Some of my underwriting has about a 20% loss to lease. Could there be a justification for using the market lease amounts as gross schedule rents to raise your strike or offer price? Well, if you've got 20% loss to lease, that management company wouldn't have a job, in my opinion, because they're not doing their job. Their job is to make the most amount of money for the owners so that they can cash out their interest on a monthly or annual basis. I mean, 20% loss to lease, that is huge. They're not doing their job. I would be having a separate management come in there, shop your property, and also shop the competition, and then come back with the results. There's a problem. And if your winning offer is 65% of what the bids are, well, that's a possibility. Maybe that you're not at the top of the market, or maybe you're giving away a lot of concessions that other people are not, such as letting employees live on your property. You don't want that. Or you don't want it part of the management salary. Or you don't want your maintenance crew living on the property. You want them coming to work, working all day, and then if they're on call at night, they get paid a bonus to make any calls. But you don't want all of your staff living on your property, not paying rent. And then the fourth question, because of the fact that you go first and mostly to family and friends when you are raising private money for your deal, is there a limit on the number of non-accredited investors you can have in your deal per the SEC? Yes, there is. You can only have 35 sophisticated investors in one deal and unlimited accredited investors. So 35 is the big number. You can't have any more than that. But in our world, we like to use accredited investors, and I may allow one in each deal that's not accredited, but that would have to be somebody that I knew or had a relationship with, and I knew they weren't going to be, you know, driving me crazy throughout the property. Anything you want to add to any of those, Jeff?
Yeah, it's just concentrate on your accredited investors. It's like you take the risk out of the deal. Sound good?
Yeah, we'll talk about the 20% loss to lease.
That's a lot, 20%. That means like...
Jeez, I can't even believe it.
Yeah, that means the management company's not doing the job, but that's the value play. It's like raising rents in that market. So if you're buying and it's at 20%, it's good. If it's your property and you're running it that way, it's bad. So it's a huge value play. As long as you can justify that loss to lease, it's like who's determining what the market value is, the market rent. And if you're... The market rent, this is the way you look at it, right? So if you have a unit that's about the same size, same amenities in a market, and someone's determining that you can get $600 for that unit, and you're only getting $500, well, that's like a $100 lease. Now, that's a $100 loss to lease, that you can capture that $100, right? So if you have 150 units and you're capturing that $100 rent increase, you multiply it. So that's $100 times 150. So say you bought it at an 8.5 cap. Well, if you get that value, the new value is, because it's like the NOI divided by the cap rate. So you have 150 units times $100 rent increase divided by an 8.5 cap. Well, that's like $2.1 million in value just added to that property by raising the rents. And also, you're getting a higher cash-on-cash return, so it's a huge value play if you can capture that loss to lease.
Very good. All right, I just got emailed a question from Steve Desmond, a couple of questions. Can you comment on the $250 reserve rule? $250 could be low. To paint the room is $300. To fix a bathroom is $3,000 a unit. The bank is going to come in and tell you what you need to carry for CapEx. We put in the $250 rule of thumb, and that's just to make sure you have money in the CapEx. But the bank is going to come and tell you what you need to carry. It could be that on your particular property, you need $600 or $700 a unit for CapEx. What I always try to do on my underwriting is whatever money I put or the bank tells me to put in CapEx, I also put in other closing costs. Because what happens with your CapEx money is the bank may hold it until you start doing the repairs. So how are you going to get the money to do the repairs if the bank just put your CapEx money in reserves until you did the repairs? So I like to have the money available. You have to submit receipts. You have 1 year to do whatever the bank tells you you have to do in that 1 year. And you have to submit receipts, and quarterly you will get reserved money sent back to you after they come out and inspect it. But if you don't have the money, the extra money, you don't want to be going to your investors and make a capital call. And you also don't want to do a promissory note, because you can't pay your investors until you pay the debt on the property, which is the promissory note. So it's a catch-22. So I like to put whatever money I'm holding for CapEx also in other closing costs, and that's to make sure I have the money to do the work. Can you comment on how to rehab a 150-unit building? If I fix 10 units, I can't rent them out. So at that rate, it would take me 15 years to rehab a building. Well, if you're buying a property at a very low price and it's a complete rehab and you've got investors in on the deal, you have to explain to them that they're not going to get any cash flow until you fix all the units up. But once those units are fixed up and rented at the premium rent, they're going to be getting, you know, very good cash flow checks from then until the end. So it's all on how you talk to your investors. On 15 years, why would it take that long to rehab 150 units? I would think if you've got a 150-unit building and you're not going to pay investors, but you're going to take whatever rents you have and get them fixed up, you should be able to do 150 units in less than 3 months, 6 months at the most. And his last question is, if I get a good deal and it meets the Holy Trinity, should I bring it to UP9 to get a sponsor? Well, Steve, you can bring it to UP9, but we do have a sponsorship event, and if you're a member of the sponsorship, you just need to tell me where the property is, how much it's going for, and what the value plays are on the property, and I can give you a sponsor. So if you'd like to call Jermaine or myself or Jeff and talk about this, you can reach out to any one of us. And he also thank you, Jeff, for your answers. So do you have anything to add, Jeff?
Okay, yeah. Let me see. All right, so on your CapEx at $250 per unit, it's going to be based on the lender's inspection on it. And what they're going to do, they're going to tell you this is what you need to be putting away each year to be able to keep the property going the way they want it, because if they have to take over that property, they want the roofs, the parking lot looking good and things like that. So that's just like the figure that you're going to have to carry every year. Now, when you're looking at the property, you have to determine, that's why you want to ask for a three-year CapEx report, find out what's been replaced, how much it costs, so you get a general idea of what needs to be done. And you'll buy some properties that will need things done right away, so you're going to have that as part of the raise, as Jeannie was talking about. So you're going to have that. Now, the second question where you were talking about renovating units. Well, if you know where you want to bring it, you have to look at what your renovation package is going to be. If it's a lighting, new cabinets, new countertops, because you don't want them to be vacant, so you want the cash flow to be coming in. So when the leases expire, what you want to do is offer the existing tenant, one of those amenities with a bump in the rent. So you have someone in there for another 12 months, but when you go in there, you're already done one of your upgrade items on there. So you're keeping the cash flow coming in. You have a strategy, so you don't just get rid of 10 people. And like Jeannie was saying, the time to do it, you have to turn around, find out what the turnaround time to do one of those, because you want to be able to just turn it fast. So you might lose 1 month on a unit, so you don't go in there and depending on the size, 150 units. You don't want to just lose these tenants as you're renovating. You want to renovate. They see what's going on. You add that amenity to it. You really don't want people moving into another unit. You'd rather rent that out at full market price to another tenant. And then the UP9, you want to bring deals to the UP9, but we have sponsorship program. But with the UP9, you're going to have sponsors at the event looking for deals. You're going to have people that are looking to fund deals, and you'll have people that will be looking for deals too. And then you'll have other people that are in different markets. So that's why you want to find out as you go through the speed networking, where we have, there's a clock, right? And we do it. We have everyone in the front row, they turn around, they look to, they turn around. So they have someone that's face to face with them. And so you have your business card. You can say who you are, what you're looking for, what you're doing, what market you're in. So that's why you want to bring business cards where you can, like, write on the back of it, so you don't want the glossy type. So then after 30 seconds, that person in front of you, now it's their turn, and they say exactly the same thing, what they're looking for, where they're from, you know, they're looking for deals. So when that 30 seconds goes off, everyone moves one over. Like the people in the second row, they stay where they are. The people in the first row, they move one to the left. So now you have someone else. So we do that about 4 or 5 times. By the end of the 3-day events, you should know, you should have like so many connections there. And if you bring a partner to it, you'll have double the connections. So you can just, well, you meet at night and say, oh, this person's on this. And then you go out to dinner with those people and stuff like that. So after UP9, yeah, stop looking for deals. Look, see, like, there'll be sponsors there that will be saying, hey, you know, if you got a deal, you know, like, don't tell anyone else about it. Let's do it right now. So this is a great opportunity. So the UP9 is, like, the greatest networking event in the world. Right, Janie?
Right. We're also going to have a Shark Tank there so you can present deals. But
I caution you,
make sure you have it under contract when you present.
Yeah, the thing about the Shark Tank, too, right, is, like, you'll be able, even if you don't have a deal, or if you don't get your deal in time to be a presenter, then you'll be able to watch how we present. And the people we're presenting to are like students just like you, but they're in other markets that have, that can sponsor deals. So they'll be asking questions like about the numbers. You know, how do you know you can bring raise rents in that market? What about the market? Are you in the right neighborhood? They're going to be asking you like key questions that, and as a spectator watching, right, you'll be like, wow, okay, I really have to hone up on this and that. So if I present it to someone. But also, right, like I remember there was a couple of people that like just stood up and said, hey, I want that deal, and they took it away from the Sharks. So it's like it's a great opportunity.
One woman came there. She was all prepared to make her presentation. She knew that property inside and out, and within 15 minutes, she had that deal funded. She walked out of
that's
there.
Right. Yeah.
Yep, she did, and she's like flying high today because all the people that wanted to fund the deal, that couldn't fund the deal, were so impressed with her that now they want to do deals with her. So money is not an object for her. She just has to find the right deal and make it count like she did the one that got funded. So
yeah,
it does happen.
Shock. Yeah, she wasn't a participant in the Shark Tank because she already had it funded, and they don't want the person that was sponsoring the deal that looked at it and said, oh, yeah, I definitely want this deal, and said, don't present it at
the Shark Tank.
So that's why we take
very quickly after.
We take other people in there. I had something else to that, too. What was it? What's my train thought on that, because I know exactly how that happened too. We're like, oh no, now we're going to take a backup person to be into that Shark Tank slot. I'll think of it. It'll come back to me.
Okay. So I have another question from Jean Onizuka. Hi, Jeannie. Sorry for the last minute question.
Hold on a second, right? You know that video thing that we're doing, right?
Yep.
Like sending a video. What can you explain what that's about right now?
What, the testimonial thing?
We're having a contest for
closing deals, and whoever has the best testimonials for closing deals is going to come to Boston and spend an entire day with Dave and the office. For the whole day, just you and him, and you'll go to the Harvard Club, and it's going to be pretty amazing. And it'll be
so. How's he going to judge that? He's going to judge it on like the deal size, or the deal itself, or like if it's a really cool video. How's he going to do that?
I really don't know.
Yeah,
I'll have to do some investigating.
Oh, Jermaine, do you know?
Jermaine, do you know?
I do. So it's going to be whoever has the best video. So use your imagination. So if you are, you know, it could be funny, it could be emotional. But we're just looking for the most creative video that you can send out, send to us about, you know, how we basically how our mentor has helped you as far as getting your deals done. So that's what you want to do.
So it could be any size deal. And like, but just think of this, right? So you're there in front of, like, I don't know, probably about 1,000 people there. You're up there, you're in stage. Do you think, like, that would be, like, a great way to get connected with everyone in that room? Because then once you get off that stage, so many people will come up to you. So that's why you want to do it, too, for the exposure at the camp. But you get a date with Dave, too.
And the other thing about the Shark Tank, just backing up a little bit, it doesn't have to be about a deal. It can be about a business as well. In fact, we had a guy present a pain medicine for your legs. Bob Bowman was having trouble with his leg. Dave had some pain in his leg. And they're putting this medicine on their leg, seeing if it works and makes them feel better. And the guy got funded for his experimental. Turned out it was like a horse tranquilizer that they made into this cream that they were putting on their legs. It's kind of weird, but yeah, it's about businesses and properties alike. So anyways, I'm going back to Jean Onozuko's question. How can you determine the A, B, C, and D properties, especially determining B and C? It's all about the years that they were built. And you do not want to go to a D property no matter what have you. We don't do Ds, and neither should you. If you're afraid to go into an area at night or you wouldn't send your kids there, you don't want a D property. So let's talk about A, B, and C. A's are like built in the 2000 and above. B's could be the 80s and up to 2000. And then C's are
It's usually like 15 to 20 years. Yeah, every 15 to 20 years like separates the classes.
Yeah, and it's all depends on the year. And I mean, some C properties could look like an A property, but their bones are still C properties, and that would affect the insurance on the property, et cetera. But don't even consider a D property, because we don't want you to do it. We don't care how brave you are. How are you going to get
it? Yeah, it could look really good, right? Like, if you have a chance, go into an old house and look at the copper. It's all green and all that. You know, copper doesn't last forever.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at. Like, the age of the property, like, that stuff breaks down. So.
Okay. So let me see if I have any other questions.
We're done. Like, operators, anyone in the queue? Yeah.
No, we have no further questions at the moment.
All right. We're done.
Okay.
Lunchtime. All right. Thank you, Jeannie.
All right. See you next time. Bye, guys.
All right. If you were nervous about asking a question, if there was something that we talked about, feel free to give us a call right here because we're here all afternoon. So just give us a call in the office, 781-878-7114, extension 111. For Jeannie, and I'm not sure what you mean, it is, but we'll...
Is this 1-8? No, it's 211.
211. So if you have any questions, just give us a call.
Jeff is, he doesn't like calls.
What? All right.
This is 103.
All right. Take care, everybody.
All right, everybody. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.